In the dark. Women alone in the dark are like open doors, Jesse, and if they scream for help, who knows what might answer.
Thank you. No, oh, wow.
Nothing's okay. Stopping you.
I mean, society.
No, society's not. You know, being a cheerleader seems very difficult, like physically very difficult.
Yeah, I don't think I could pick anybody up.
It is tough. Like I did middle school cheer and then making the transition to high school cheer, I couldn't
crushed
do stunts.
Your dreams.
So that's it's a lot more physically demanding than most people think.
I watched mm-hmm. Bring It On.
Yeah, exactly. I love that movie. Okay. Oh, we're recording.
Mm-hmm. Cool. That's a nice little cold open there about cheerleading.
We love cheerleading.
We're cheerleaders of the Flaniverse.
Ooh, oh my God. Wait, how do you... What's a cheer?
I don't think a cheer is just anything.
M-I-E-E. Mike. Let's go, girls. Thank you.
Well, on that note, welcome to the monologue, everybody.
Hi.
Hello. Welcome back.
My name is Cecilia. I'm joined by my co-hosts, Riley and Kelsey.
Hello.
I'm Riley.
I'm Kelsey.
Perfect. Yeah, here at the monologue, we do a thematic deep dive into the works of Mike Flanagan, exploring recurring motifs, creative processes, and collaborations in the Flaniverse. This week, we are going to be covering what we're calling Haunted by the Past. So trauma and memory in the works of Gerald's Game, Dr. Sleep, and Absentia.
And whatever else comes up along the way.
I feel like a lot of things could fit in that category. Like almost everything in the Flaniverse could probably fit in that.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. There's some deep seated trauma. I feel like we're always talking about trauma, guys.
Trauma's part of life.
Yeah,
it is.
The main part of life sometimes.
It's everywhere, especially now.
Oh God. Yeah. In the year of our Lord 2025. Oof.
What do you mean? It's going well.
I have no idea. No idea what you're talking about.
Well, they're burning down the Tesla dealerships now, so I guess...
Burning down the house.
Well. All right, yeah, a little dance break.
The works that we are going to be discussing deal a lot with trauma survivors, so really watching their journey through a very specific trauma that's happened to them, and them in... their more adult lives and how they cope and deal with it and how it really affects how they end the their respective movies. That was a lot of blather. Sorry. I am a little sleepy.
That's what we could rename the podcast, honestly. But yeah, I feel like this is going to be a very, very interesting episode as someone who has already written a whole essay about Dr. Sleep and memories and your mind literally being the place that all of your trauma took place at. So I'm excited to get into it and hear you guys' thoughts.
Yeah, and I think we have a nice range. So if we're focusing on Absentia, which is like early Flaniverse, and then Gerald's Game is a little bit later. It was just before Hill House, right?
Yeah, I think Gerald's Game is 2017, and then Hill House
is 2018. So, yeah. And then Dr. Sleep was 2019?
Yeah, I think, yeah. It
was that sounds right.
Before pandemic stuff.
So it's still technically all early Flaniverse, but we have like early with Absentia all the way to like pre-pandemic.
The evolution of that is very, very interesting when we talk about the way these movies end for each character as well.
Varying degrees of ends for these different characters. So out of the three works, we have three main characters that are going through a trauma that they are clearly coping with.
So we have Dan Torrance in Dr. Sleep. We have Jesse Burlingame in Gerald's Game, and then I don't remember Callie's last name, but Callie.
I do because it's my first
Yes.
name. It's Riley.
Ah, Callie Riley.
Yeah,
Okay. In
Trisha and
absentia.
Callie.
Okay, so we've got the names of our three main characters.
Yeah, and there's a lot of different traumas that are happening.
You guys want to talk about that? You want to, should we talk about Absentia and just kind of explain the setup so that we can sort of go through each movie and watch the progression?
Yeah, I think that works because Absentia has a very different tone than the other ones. So
Yes.
it might be good to start there.
What happens in Absentia? There's a, a man who's declared dead in absentia. I guess that's why it's named that.
Yeah, I guess we kind of have dual protagonists in absentia
I
in a
do. I
way.
consider the sisters because when I was doing my notes, I was actually thinking more about Trisha than I was
Yeah.
Callie, Katie Parker's character.
I think I was thinking of Callie because of the fact that Callie is clearly dealing with her past trauma through addiction. And through drug use. And so that's a little more obvious, where I think her sister is really trying to use almost religion as a coping mechanism. We see her meditating a lot, like she's just trying to figure out how to cope with it.
Yeah, or like maybe spirituality would
That's a
possibly
better
be.
way.
Yeah, because I'm not sure that we go into many religious themes, but I do think her kind of grief pulling her back into and kind of creating this loop in the film is sort of the angle that I was thinking about it from. But you can definitely see a lot of that with Callie's character as well, with like the drug use. And that comes up a lot in Flanniverse works as well, because then we've got Luke from Hill House, and then we've got Riley with his alcohol addiction in Midnight Mass. So that is very interesting to see that it's been a thread throughout.
And we also have in Bly Manor, we have the uncle.
Oh yeah, the pouring whiskey in his tea. I've honestly, I don't know why. Maybe it's because he is the most like functioning of the characters, but I honestly rarely ever think about him in terms of alcoholism. So that's really interesting to point out.
Yeah, I'm sure it has something to do with the fact that Mike Flanagan himself has suffered with addiction. And so I think that is probably something that not only he works into the things he works on, but also probably something he gravitates towards when he's adapting something, because it's something that he can kind of relate to, knowing that struggle personally.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I think it's interesting to see that even before coming to terms with addiction, it was a very present thing in his work. But I think now in this year and what Mike has been open with about his journey, it's very interesting to see the drastic like tone change when it comes to how some of these characters' lives turn out and, are implied to work out.
For those of you who have not seen Absentia, it's a movie about there's two sisters. One of the sisters' husbands has dis or her husband has disappeared. He's been gone for 7 years, so essentially they're going to declare him dead. He's missing. He's in absentia, and her sister is coming back home to help her deal with the process. And then some shenanigans happen with a mysterious tunnel and a monster that may or may not or may exist. And
Who knows?
that's
It's hard to tell when you're all doped up
the
or when
quick.
you're just suffering the trauma of losing your husband and him coming back suddenly.
It's interesting to see the different forms of trauma. I don't remember. Do we get a lot about their childhood? They've got some stuff in there. Do they have stuff in their chat? I can't remember.
There's not, it doesn't really go into detail. Like we do, both of the sisters have coping mechanisms. Like Callie has the drug use, and then Trisha has like the, like you were saying, the spirituality, like religious aspect. It's interesting. Like, it's almost like one, like Callie's addiction is like the non-societally acceptable way of coping with your problems, and then like Trisha's is like one that's like can be just as dangerous. I mean, i.e. midnight mass, but it's also kind of viewed as more societally acceptable. So it's like it's kind of showing the two extremes.
Oh, that's really interesting. I wonder if that's just because it's more of you're like a danger to yourself when you are a drug user as well as everyone else, so it's a bit more obvious.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I find it really fascinating that, I mean, I guess they both deal with their trauma with religion because Callie is newly into Christianity when she
Oh,
gets there.
yeah, one of the few things that she does put up in the room when she gets there is a cross, right?
Yeah. So that's interesting, but I think you're right in like what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. Drug use is never acceptable. It's also something that's really hard, I feel like, for a lot of people to forgive, if somebody has stepped down that road. The sister is, when I watch Absentia, I do wonder if part of it is her not being able to cope or society forcing her to not be able to cope. Like, the dutiful thing as a wife is that you keep putting up signs no matter what you do. You keep doing it. You keep doing it.
That is true because, I mean, if you think about it, she does kind of seem ready to move on. Like, she has that relationship with the, is it the police officer?
The detective, yeah.
And yeah, and like the, like it's his baby, right? That she's pregnant with when we, yeah. So, I mean, she has moved on, but then maybe she, like, society is kind of what's causing her to like continue with the coping mechanisms, because it's like, oh, well, I feel like society would say that I shouldn't have moved on, even though she has.
And we see, like, I feel so bad. It's not funny, but when she calls his parents to be like, "Your son's alive," and by the time they show up, he's gone again.
Oh,
I'm
no.
like,
Like the parents
oh
have just been holding on,
no.
which I'm sure
What a
is,
terrible prank.
I'm sure it's also a reason why she's probably found it really hard to move on because the parents are also just like, "No, he's still out there. You can't move on."
Well, and I wonder if
Yeah.
that too is like everyone around you just keeps reminding you of it. So you are just stuck living in that moment all the time. So even when you want to let go, you just get sucked into a tunnel by a monster, apparently.
So maybe one of the things that it's trying to show us is that like trauma and trauma responses can be greatly influenced by who you surround yourselves with, because she is still like Trish is still like in contact, still has the parents of her husband who has disappeared, kind of like, nope, he's gonna come back, he's still here, and like the expectation that it's like you're still his wife, as opposed to like people telling her like you can let go, it's okay to let go, it's okay to move on. So that like further exacerbates the trauma because she's like kind of getting conflicting messages.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And Callie coming back is really like, because Callie is one of the few people I'm guessing in her life that's like, that is honestly means it. Like, you should move on. It's time. So I guess that's part of, right? Like, a lot of trauma, not a lot, but some trauma is trauma you deal with your family, like other siblings, especially. I find that they're kind of each other's, they kind of cope with each other as well when Callie gets back, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, leaning on somebody that you trust.
I would like, actually, so Cecilia and I both have a ton of siblings.
A gaggle.
Yeah, too many, honestly. We should get some. But like I wonder, as an only child, because I think I see a lot of like I can relate to a lot of the things that Mike writes because we are both eldest siblings, maybe. Siblings comes up in, I think, all of his work except for Gerald's Game. So I would love to have an only child's opinion on any of that.
I don't really. I guess the only thing that has really made me think about siblings and the impact of that would be Hill House, because there's so many of them. I don't know. I never really, I mean, obviously, like, Callie and Trisha are siblings, but I never really thought of that as being, like, a unique sibling bond. Because, I mean, I have, like, cousins that I'm close with, and so that would be the same kind of thing. Hill House was the only thing where I was like, oh, like, Hill House, I think I relate to Nell more, because even amongst my cousins, like, I'm the youngest, and so I was kind of always treated as, like, in the younger sibling role. But yeah. I haven't really thought about how that would impact other works.
Yeah, maybe that's something to talk about in a future episode. I just always find that very, very interesting. Yeah. And unfortunately, I'm a person who has to say, yeah, I relate to Stephen Crane the most because I'm the oldest sibling. And I'm like, yeah, I understand this experience.
Oh, I relate to Nell.
Yeah, because you're the baby.
I'm the baby.
Yeah.
That would probably fit in more with like a Hill House analysis.
Yeah, well, because back.
Yeah, because even though now that you mention it, like, yeah, there are siblings in pretty much everything except for Gerald's Game, it doesn't really become as central to the plot as it does in Hill House.
But it is always, have mentioned, it is always family stuff. And I feel like that's also something that generational trauma is represented a lot in all of these works as well.
Well, you can still have generational trauma without having siblings.
That's what I meant. And I find it interesting that, like, a lot of the time in Dr. Sleep especially, that can be represented by a literal house. And the atmosphere of Absentia, it gives me that as well, because it's still the house that she was, like, living in, making a life with her now missing for the second time husband. So the environment of these things is also very interesting.
Like, the setting itself is another character.
Yeah,
because it kind of, obviously, like, she's going to have memories there of, like, her husband before he was missing. And so it's going to contribute things to, like, the mood of the situation that wouldn't be there if she had, like, moved to a new place that had no association to him.
Yeah. And that's, like, is it almost manifesting these monsters because of that?
I think it probably has something to do with it. I mean, she's quite literally seeing her imagined version of, like, a ghost.
Yeah.
In the house all the time, up until the very end. And it makes sense, because memories are, you know, they are your trauma. So, or they can be your trauma. So I think places for sure hold those.
And you could probably say the same thing about the setting being another character, about Dr. Sleep as well, because we have in the movie version where Dan goes back into the Overlook and, like, has that interaction, like, with the ghost or the spirit of his father.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man, that's so, every time I watch that scene, it's so rough.
God, I wish you got, when your dad dies, you get to go, like, yell at him at the bar. That would be very cathartic.
They're going to say, I wish I just got a big haunted inn.
Well, I did. I inherited a big haunted house. I wrote a whole thing about it.
There's the Stephen Crane vibes continued.
They really, truly do. It never stops.
Yeah. Oh,
God, he's such an asshole, though. What am I going to do?
You're not him, so you're okay.
Oh, well, for now. We'll see. But I the same goes for Gerald's Game too, though, because the environment and atmosphere is basically the antagonist of that film, because she's just stuck there, chained there.
For those of you who have not done your homework and have not seen Gerald's Game, it's a movie about a husband and a wife that go to, like, some remote cabin house in the woods to try something new with their sex life, which involves handcuffs. And, you know, what do you do when the person who handcuffed you to the bed dies and you're stuck there and there's nothing you can do?
Well, the answer is don't use real handcuffs.
I have so many.
Don't use police-grade handcuffs.
There's so many unsafe kink practices here. Like, it's insane to me. But it makes sense for Gerald's character.
Yeah. You guys want to scoot into that a little bit now that
I've... Let's scoot into Gerald's game. There's no trauma there, right? It's very light.
Oh, yeah. There's,
It's really hard to figure out what her trauma might be.
Oh.
It's just sunshine and rainbows and puppies and butterflies.
No, I
puppies,
remember.
Puppies, for sure. Loves dogs.
I remember an eclipse. Not so much nice weather.
I had to fast forward through that scene when I watched it, because I was just like, I can't. No, I can't.
Most of the time, Henry Thomas plays a guy who I would want to be my dad. Not this time. It's no good. And there's also, once you learn her backstory, Jesse, our main characters, it's pretty easy to see how and why she starts, like, dissociating and hallucinating. It's easy to see why, because childhood abuse, I don't think, is something that's going to linger forever, and you can definitely overcome it, but it's hard to even take that first step in, like, talking about it.
I think Mike Flanagan does a really good job of, I think if you're somebody who can recognize the signs of trauma, you see the signs really fast from the beginning. And I think he does a good job of, without telling you, especially at the beginning, you can kind of figure out that, like, something might have happened, whether you don't know what exactly it is. It definitely is, you can tell it's a sexual trauma from the way she acts with her husband. But it's just so much worse than you would hope. Not that you would hope trauma, but it's so much worse than you want it to be.
Yeah, it's not an easy watch. It's a great film. It's a great book. But yeah, like you said, if you know anything about trauma, I've been doing a lot of, like, research into complex PTSD, and it's... Jesse, from the very beginning, has a lot of signs of this that Gerald is truly just disregarding.
For sure. And I think you can see, I think, a really good representation of her trauma and the fight and struggle she has is definitely after everything happens and Gerald's, you know, he's at the end of the bed or on the floor, yeah, and she's handcuffed up, and you get two different, essentially like an angel and the devil talking to her. Do you guys want to talk about that, her personified version of herself and Gerald? Personified? That's not the right word. Whatever the word's supposed to be.
Like, yeah, imagined version.
Yeah. I will say I did not watch Gerald's Game before this film, or before this recording. But I do remember her being a lot more assertive, but also, like, bad. And I think that's what a lot of PTSD and abuse survivors, they have this version of themselves that is like, if I do anything wrong, I am bad. And I think, you know, it's almost like blaming herself for what happened to her, just with the way you can see she views herself.
Yeah, I kind of got that a lot more from Gerald's, fake Gerald, his perspective, because he's definitely like the devil. Like, he's definitely the personification of her trauma. Like, essentially, like, you know, you're stupid, you're dumb, you can't get out of this, I can't believe you'd ever think this. And then she's got, like, her actual self that I feel like is constantly trying to bust through, which is the, you got this, like, put the water back, remember where you, it's very instructive. So it's almost very, like, clinical. in the way that, like, her mind, it's how she's surviving. Her, like, it's her survival instinct being like, okay, let's be a little bit more methodical. Don't listen to him. And it's a lot of going back and forth.
I'm wondering, because I've read the book more recently, this was not a thing that happened in the book with her, like, double.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a character that she talks to throughout, but I believe it was just a friend that she knew or someone who she thought was, like, you know, what I was describing before. But you are right now that I am remembering the movie a bit better.
I haven't read Gerald's Game, but it's definitely cut down to being pretty much as soon as Gerald dies and he's on the floor, we get two different personas. That's the word I'm looking for. Personas.
Oh,
it's Gerald, her interpretation, her view of Gerald, which is also a view of herself through her own trauma. And then it's got, like, the strong self, the, like, surviving instinct of her to, like, keep her going through the trauma. And they do kind of bicker back and forth, and they're trying to get her to pay attention to them. And it's really through, I mean, in the end, she does save herself, but I think a lot of that is her learning to listen to that part that has kept her alive. That really helps her get out of it.
The two voices, like, reminds me again of Absentia, how we have, like, the two sisters and, like, the two different, like, favorable versus unfavorable, or, like, societally acceptable versus non-societally acceptable, I cannot talk, ways of coping. Like, the two voices for her, it's, like, the, like, these are the good ideas that you need to do to save yourself. And, like, if you wanted to just kind of wallow in your pity and feel sorry for yourself, like, this is what you could do. So it's, like, she does have, like, kind of the two options for, like, how to cope with her situation.
Okay. I like that. It's very interesting, though, that she finally does, like, stand up to Gerald after his death. So it's almost like she needed that to break free, like a literal representation of her trauma leaving,
and then she gets to gloved.
Yeah, that's true. And
rough scene.
The like manifesting, like, the negative talk as Gerald probably made it easier for her to, like, not give into that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So maybe that was something that helped her to kind of overcome that trauma. Because if it was just kind of like two sides to herself, like, I don't know if it would have been as, it wouldn't have been as clear cut as it is by, like, making it the manifestation of Gerald.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's perfectly correct. That makes a lot of sense. It would have been really weird if it had been two versions of herself.
It would have become too much like a Fall of the House of Usher. There's just too many Carlas walking around.
Yeah. And that I would have been, so, I mean, it kind of, like, it helps, like, from a plot perspective, but then also for the audience to be able to follow it, because having the negative voices be the persona of Gerald would make a lot more sense and be a lot less confusing than, like, having two versions of Jesse.
Yeah.
And I think it's her really, like, learning to become, not become herself, but, like,
trust herself.
There is an element of survival that you see with her, especially at the beginning, where she's essentially just, like, placating almost.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the whole reason they're at this cabin is because he couldn't get it up one day and then was rough with her, got it up and said, oh, okay, let's go to a cabin and I'm gonna handcuff you. We're not gonna have any conversation about it. No safety discussion, no words, no, stop doesn't mean stop. And she's just like, okay.
Yeah, like, the whole, that's a good point. The whole reason that they're there, it's because of him. Mm-hmm. So, like, her, that kind of adds an additional layer to the meaning behind her escape. Like, she's escaping from the situation that she probably didn't want to be in the first place.
Oh,
and it's so sad, because it's such a, like, her first instance of real trauma with her dad is not a scenario that she got herself into, but the result of it is her dad asking her to be quiet and gaslighting her to believe that if she says anything, she'll destroy the family. And so in a way, she gets herself into the situation by agreeing to be quiet. And I'm sure that's something that's just really haunted her.
Well, and I'm sure that that's where a lot of the self-doubt from survivors comes from as well. Mm-hmm. And that's shown very clearly, especially with her then having to learn to trust herself when she has doubted everything because of having a parent that gaslit her entire childhood.
But do you think that, like, the trauma, the childhood trauma, was a necessary experience for her to end up in the present day situation with Gerald?
Do we think that she would have ended up, though? Because would she have been able to stand up for herself? That is what she needed as a kid, and that is, thankfully, the progression of this film is a lot more hopeful than the previous one we talked about.
I think it has to do with the cycle of trauma. I mean, it's like people who have an abusive family member and then end up in an abusive relationship. Or they're just like, I'll never be like my mom. I'll never, you know, be in a situation where my significant other is going to hit me. And then they end up in the same one. I think trauma from an early age can, unfortunately, like, ingrain itself into you, that you follow the patterns without realizing you're following patterns. In Gerald's game, I don't even think she's realized that she's followed the patterns until she's talking with her subconscious selves and they're pointing out things that she just, like, probably pushed away. Like, when they bring up the pills, he's just like, yeah, you know, you didn't even acknowledge when you saw me taking the Viagra, so I never said anything and you never said anything. We just kind of accepted it was life.
I just thought of something, and this is probably like nothing, but in my head I had like a mind-blowing moment. So her trauma started with the Eclipse situation, and then the man, that is he a necrophiliac, is that what he's
the Moonlight Man,
yeah, so yeah. Like the Moonlight Man. So we have started with the Eclipse, and then she kind of conquered her trauma by, like, the whole, like, freeing herself and, like, the, like, giving, does she give, she gives testimony at the trial, right?
She,
that's the whole, you're so much smaller than I.
She just walks into the courtroom and he's, like, getting arraigned, I think. And, like, she's like, hey, and then he turns around and everyone else turns around, and then she gives the whole speech at him. And then he starts saying the thing about, like, you're not real. You're just moonlight.
So it starts with an eclipse and it ends with the Moonlight Man.
Oh.
I mean, yeah, it starts with the eclipse. We get the Moonlight Man. And then at the end, she walks away and the eclipse ends. So, like, it's the moon moving away.
It's the whole continuation of, like, the moon.
Yeah.
Guys, I love symbolism.
And the moon is such, a female-centric, like, celestial body.
Oh, that's a good point, because it is known for being, like, very feminine, and so the eclipse is, like, kind of covering the, yeah.
I see.
Like, there's probably gonna be people listening and being like, yeah, I figured that out the first time that I watched it, and I'm just like, well, excuse us.
Well, listen, this, I think, probably between the three of us is our, like, least revisited, because the it's very tough to watch.
It's got two bad scenes. Three it, bad yeah,
it's,
scenes.
It's got
it's two. A lot of bad well, scenes.
It's got it's two, bad. Like, 10 bad scenes for me. One, the scene with her dad. The other scene, the degloving. It's so hard to watch.
I would just like to clarify, though, that when we say bad scenes, we don't mean that they are made poorly. No. We mean that they're emotionally triggering, so that actually means that they are made very well that gave us that reaction. I just want to clarify that in case anybody is like, why are they calling it that?
Yes. Okay. Thank you for the clarification, because I do, we're not trash talking.
No.
The scenes are done really well. Yeah, yeah. If they weren't, we would not be reacting the way we are.
But yes.
I would like to circle back, and I would like to talk about Kate Siegel, which is not surprising, because I want to talk about Kate Siegel all the time.
In Gerald's game?
Yeah, she plays the mom.
the well, bitch I
know.
Mom.
Yeah, yes, I know. But like, it seems weird that like of all of the things in the Flanniverse that you have strong Kate Siegel opinions about Gerald's Game, where she's in it for like 5 minutes.
Well, that's the thing. I don't know if I have strong opinions because I. I just want to talk about Kate. No.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of like the relationship between Jesse and her mom.
It's
rough, but it's rough because her dad again is like pitting them against each other. So
her mom does figure it out though.
Does she?
There's that one scene, the one that gives her the idea for the degloving, where she like is holding the, she thinks back to when she was holding the glass and she is like squeezing it so hard that it breaks. And then it's shows her mom is like, gives this look. It's like she figured out what's going on, but then it like the table, like the memory fades to black. So you don't see what happens after. So I feel like her mom figured it out.
Well, and that's my assumption as well, and then moving forward with the way that Jesse turns out as an adult makes me think that it just became something known that wasn't talked about. So now it's another like layer of shame on top of what she's already feeling. So this whole situation that she's gotten into does kind of seem inevitable.
That's a good point. Because, yeah, even though the mom does, it looks like she figured it out, like, we don't know what happens next. So, arguably, it is just kind of dusted under the rug.
Yeah, because we don't really get anything with, like, present tense about, like, her parents, about her siblings.
Yeah.
But in my mind, there's no way her mom didn't know, because one of the classic signs of trauma is like Jesse, the day that the abuse happens, is wearing a shorter dress. And she even mentions that like mom says she doesn't like it because it's shorter. She says it's too short. And then right after, you know, the abuse happens, she's in a long sleeve shirt, long pants. And I'm sure she stayed like that. I mean, even like in the present tense, her lingerie is like so mild that it almost makes you think like this is the most she can do even for lingerie.
Oh yeah, because I guess it's kind of
I'm sure it was also probably much easier to film in a skimpy getup.
Because she had to wear that the entire time.
Yeah, I mean, I've never really thought about that, but yeah, I mean, that does make sense because yeah, I do remember the comments about like the dress being too short and that it was like kind of revealing, and then yeah, I didn't even pay attention to that, but that's a good catch.
Well, and the thing that makes me think her mom also would not have admitted or whatever is because you're right, she was the one who pointed it out, and it comes off as like that she was asking for it kind of stigma that then happens. But like, that's a little if you sexualize children, you're weird.
Yeah.
And clearly, like Jesse never had a conversation. Like, that never became a conversation she and her mom had. So Jesse will never know. Like, I think her mom clearly knew. But was it something where, like, her mom, like, blamed her daughter? Or it was something that she just couldn't accept had happened to one of her children by someone she thought she loved? And she just feels ashamed. And so that's why it never comes up. So we don't really know.
Well, and I think that cycle of shame, too, is probably what you're seeing happen with Jesse and her mom. So, yeah, not a good place to be in for anybody.
We don't really know a lot about Jesse's mom. And if there's cyclical abuse happening, maybe that's why Jesse's mom was like, you can't wear that. It's too short.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Trauma's a wild thing.
Yep. But you can break the cycle. You just have to either go to a lot of therapy or
peel your hand off.
Peel your hands off. One or the other.
Or go to a haunted hotel and have some words with the ghost of your father.
Ooh, square up with your dead dad. A dream come true for all of us.
Yeah,
me. I'm the only one with a dead dad here, I think. Yep.
Yeah.
Whoops.
So, what a fun segue. Let's talk about Doctor Sleep, which is a, just like Gerald's Game, it's a Stephen King adaptation. It's the sequel to The Shining. The movie version is a little different than the book version, because the movie version has to balance both the Kubrick film and the book. But it's essentially, we catch up with Danny Torrance as an adult and his relationship with another child. She's a teen. I guess they meet when she's a child, sort of. Another kid who's shining, and then the threat of a group of people who like to kill and eat the essence of people who shine.
Oh, man.
The true nuts.
The true nuts. Those people. I'm so sorry, guys. Yeah, Dan Torrance. What a guy. He's going through it. He is not coping well.
I mean, can you blame him after everything that he saw in The Overlook when he was little? Still seeing. Yeah, still seeing. Followed him out of the hotel.
What a great representation of trauma, though, to just have literal ghosts following you all throughout your life.
Really, truly. It's like, hey, remember that bad thing that happened to you? Oh, I was the bad thing?
I like the very straight metaphor of boxing up your trauma. And then once you finally release it, it saves you.
Yes. Oh, man. We love bottling up our emotions here on the Monologue Podcast.
It's just, yeah, that's interesting now that you mention it. Because in real life, I feel like most, like, psychiatrists would be like, no, don't bottle that up. We have to figure out what's at the root of it so we can get through it. Yeah. But if he had done that and gotten rid of it, it wouldn't be there to help him.
Well, he doesn't get through his trauma until he's able to quite literally let all his ghosts out of the box. What's in the box?
Oh, God. It's a bunch of ghosts.
Ah!
Oh, no. I'm trying to think of the scene that they do with him and Wendy, once they have left the Overlook and they're in Florida and...
Danny's still a kid, yeah.
Danny's still a kid, and it just seems like, oh no, you already have so much to live up to, and your mother can't even look you in the eye because of the things that have happened. And there, again, is so much shame and guilt right there with both of them. And at no point did they, like, confide in each other? Because I think Wendy dies pretty soon.
She dies when he's 20.
Yeah, she's not around for too much longer of his life. And I,
yeah, because he's in his 30s, 40s?
I would assume.
He's in his 40s.
Yeah, I would assume Ewan McGregor, when he played him, was probably, like, what, late 40s, maybe? I'm not sure how old he is right now, actually. But yeah, we would assume it's about then.
Doctor Sleep takes place, well, it was present day when it came out, right?
Oh, yeah.
So
if we're basing it on that, it would be, what, 30?
Yeah, so yeah, it probably was 40s.
I would love to take my entire family to therapy with me and just force them to, like, talk through everything. And in this film, I feel like Danny could have benefited from that so much, because he has trauma bonded with his mom, but now it just becomes like a shame spiral.
I mean, I don't even ever think he really confides in his mom like she probably wants him to. He just kind of literally boxes and bottles it up, and then he tells her, I'm fine. And well, then he just keeps saying, I'm fine.
For her sake, I'm sure, too, because he doesn't want her to have to relive that.
Well, and she doesn't have the shine, right? So she wouldn't be seeing the things that he is seeing. And yeah. So to try and explain that to someone who hasn't experienced it would probably be difficult too, especially for like a child to try to do.
The relationship between Dan and Abra in the film could come off as very not okay, whereas in the book they are directly related, so it makes sense. But I think because they both share that very unique experience, it's like, oh, he becomes more of a mentor character than anything. I think that's handled really, really well.
Yeah, I think they do a good job of establishing that with Dick Halloran and the fact that he comes back a couple times. So really drills in the fact that, like, look, I mentored you. I was mentored by my grandma. You got to mentor this girl.
I personally like that in the movie version that they're not related. It's kind of like how in the Star Wars sequels, originally Rey wasn't supposed to be related to the Skywalkers or like the Palpatines or anything, and it was like just anybody can have this power. So in the Mike Flanagan Dr. Sleep universe, anybody could have the shine. It's not like explained away by like, oh, like you are related to like this family.
The mighty Torrances.
I think it also makes everything less messy because, like, I understand why Stephen King wrote it that way, but then now it's like, oh, Jack is off having affairs that we didn't know about, and, like, if you've read the book, he's got so much more shit going on. He doesn't have time for that. But
so I wonder, like, based on the book's logic then, like, since we find out that Abra and Dan are related, so would that mean that, like, all of the kids, like Baseball Boy and, like, the little girl in the campground, would they all have to be descendants of the Torrances for that to work?
I wouldn't think so, right?
I haven't read the book. My guess is that's the reason why Danny and Abra have such a strong connection. Like, he's not connected with the other people that shine.
But then Abra has a strong connection with the Baseball Boy.
I don't know either.
I haven't read the book, so unclear.
I haven't either.
I know the major differences, but other than that...
Yeah, I have read the book, but it was a couple summers ago, so I don't remember, but yeah, that would just be interesting if you think about, like, in order to have the shine, you have to, but anyway.
Yeah, that would make the Stephen King universe even more confusing than it is, because so many of his characters
have the shine. Shining. Right? Mm-hmm. Aren't all the kids from It supposed to, like, have the shine?
I think most, like, any main character with, like, Charlie from Firestarter for sure does. Probably all the kids from It.
Which, if they're all related, that makes things even worse.
We don't want to go there.
Speaking of trauma.
God. If this was a Stephen King podcast, that would be a good one for talking about trauma. But, you know, that is the King cast, and we're not going to infringe on their territory. So,
We'll migrate them over here at some point, probably. But, yeah, we'll leave it over there for now.
Yeah, so, I mean, I feel like the clearest way that Danny deals with his trauma is by also becoming an alcoholic and quite literally using the phrases his dad has said at him. Like, he gets in a fight in the movie and he goes, take your medicine, then punches a guy. I'm like, yikes.
Yeah, he really internalized that. I guess it becomes direct abuse at some point, and it's definitely implied that he has physically harmed his child before. But
it's stated in the book version. Yeah, of The Shining. He broke his arm.
I don't know if they ever do. They ever directly say that? Because in the book they do. Do they in the film? I don't remember.
In the movie version of The Shining, yeah. I just rewatched it recently.
I think
there is the scene. There's a scene in the doctor's office, I think, right? Where Wendy is taking Danny to the doctor. So I think it's mentioned.
And then I think he might talk again about it. Jack might talk about it to Lloyd. I haven't seen The Shining in a minute, so I can't remember. But I feel like there is another conversation that he either has with somebody, that he was just like, I didn't mean to do it, but it happened.
I think you're right.
Abuse and drinking, those are great things to leave as your legacy.
Yeah, we love turning into our parents, especially when we've trapped ourselves in the place that our parents abused us. No wonder this man is drunk and doing heroin.
It's bad, and then he leaves that poor mom and her baby.
that, and I still don't know if she actually died or if the thought of it just haunted him, but that is one of the most terrifying things I have seen in a movie.
I think it's meant to imply that she did, because with the shine, I think he can see what actually happened. But oh, I mean, I could be true. I could be wrong.
No, that makes sense, because in my mind, I was like, it might just be the literal guilt of that, like knowing he left her there. But it also could be a literal ghost. And that's the thing about trauma. It fucks with your head, and sometimes you don't know what's real and what's not. Which is also probably why Danny is locking away all of these ghosts in his mind palace.
Danny having to go back to the hotel, that's another level of trauma. And him having the whole conversation with his dad that is not his dad. Maybe it's his dad, maybe it's the hotel, maybe it's both.
I'm going to say probably both. And for the, you know, purpose of the film and Danny's journey, I'm going to say it's his dad because he needed it to be.
But we remember we said earlier that like the building, the setting is also a character. So I think it would fit for it to be both, because then him getting that moment, it's like resolution of the issues with his dad and the issues from the hotel itself. But it's definitely more satisfying that the actual hotel is still there in the movie version, because in the book version, it just, all these events take place on like the land where the hotel used to be, and it's just not the same level of
catharsis that you get when he burns the place that he literally destroys his trauma.
It's just, it's more, no offense to Stephen King, but I feel like that was a more satisfying ending for that story.
Yeah.
And I mean, it makes sense that Stephen King couldn't have it in the hotel when he decided to destroy it at the end of the first book. So,
yeah.
But it was fun that Mike Flanagan got to kind of play around and be like, well, what if the hotel is still there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Some of the like set design and set pieces in this film also add a lot to, because if you're watching this film, you've probably watched the Kubrick version of The Shining, so you're familiar with, like, the doctor's office is set up literally exactly the same, and just kind of watching Dan have to live in his dad's shadow is so interesting. I wonder if, too, the book had been called Unadaptable so many times for so many reasons, but the Overlook not existing, I feel like, had to be a big one. So being able to kind of appease all of the fans of the book and the film and the miniseries, you kind of needed it to physically be there.
Yeah, it just makes a lot of sense.
It just fits better for like the resolution of trauma. So,
yeah.
Speaking about the resolution of trauma, the last thing we get of the movie is, because when Danny finally learns how to kind of like lock his trauma away, it's him with the woman in the bathtub in 237, and that's how the movie ends, with Abra doing it. So the ghosts are still alive, the trauma is still there. I guess you just can't, there are some things you just can't set on fire and explode with boilers.
Well, and I think it's also like, you don't necessarily want to forget the things that happen to you, you just want a better way to cope. Like in Absentia, the main characters are implied dead by the end of that film, and it feels very hopeless. In Doctor Sleep, at the other end, years and years later, Dan is not alive by the end of the film, but it feels so much more hopeful because of what he has done for Abra. And I think that's what it's all about when it comes to any kind of generational trauma, is just breaking that cycle and making it easier for the people who come after you. Abra's not going to have to like hide as much of herself that Dan had to.
Yeah, the difference in Danny not being able to tell his mom what happened and Abra specifically talking to her mom.
Yeah, great scene. Great way to wrap that film up as well. It's very bittersweet, but it is very uplifting and very hopeful.
It is. It's definitely a tonal shift from like Absentia. It's like they kind of fell into their grief and trauma. Like, there was no way around it. And then Abra has been essentially freed from this generational trauma curse because of Dan.
It really shows also the journey that Mike has had with his sobriety and everything else, that viewpoint can change and things can get better.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't think about that, but yeah, that does kind of, because at the time when Absentia was made, it might have seemed all-encompassing and like it was always going to be there. And then he had gotten sober by the time they filmed Dr. Sleep, right?
I think he was
I
going through
think
it
it
during.
was like during the filming of it, right? So
I
it's kind of
believe
like
so, yeah.
there is a light at the end of the tunnel and you're not stuck in the tunnel, like literal tunnel in Absentia, but
Oh yeah, literally. No, yeah, I love that. And even like you pointed out, yeah, I think that was the beginning of Mike's sobriety journey. So even just taking that first step and knowing that something good could come out of it, it's very hopeful. It's very nice.
yeah.
It's really nice. Sorry, I was trying to get this cat to jump on my lap.
I thought I heard a cat somewhere and I wasn't sure if it was like one of them here. Usually, anytime there's any kind of recording, Nora shows up,
Not
but she's
today.
not.
I have an
So I don't know.
appearance yet. Well, there's still time. We should probably wrap this shit up so I can get beat at trivia.
Oh, there was one other.
It's not trivia, it's a game, right?
Oh, I was like, bar trivia?
Don't know. I'm gonna watch Jeopardy later.
So
Maybe.
don't you Okay, when we did Horror Struck, every once in a while I would just have like a random game. It's just like that.
Yeah,
I love
it's not
games.
anything stressful.
Yeah.
I
You
have to
got
win it,
this.
though.
No, you
Even if you
don't.
physically, mentally, emotionally cannot win, I need to win.
Okay, well.
I should give you the so today I subbed kindergarten for part of the day. I should give you the affirmations that the teacher was giving the kindergartners in the
Oh my God,
morning.
yes.
I need them.
I am strong.
I am
I am
strong.
strong.
I am brave.
I am brave.
I'm gonna have a good day.
I'm gonna have a good day.
Maybe.
I can do this.
I
I
can do
can
this.
do this.
Kells would be the
Riley.
best, like, trauma, like, imagined person to ever have, like, when you're going through crisis.
Oh, if I
What
were
do you mean,
treated like
imagine,
that,
like person talking in someone's
yes,
mind?
you
Yeah.
show up and you're like,
You would
you
be.
can do this. Rip
Yeah,
your head
you.
off.
It! Think fast.
You got
I mean, I feel like it comes with the territory, like being a teacher, you kind of are, you're a cheerleader for your kids all or your students all day
Oh,
long. So it's
God.
like we started talking with cheerleaders and we're ending talking about cheerleaders.
Oh, it's perfect. It's all come full circle.
It just goes with trauma really well. Cheerleaders for
Cheerleaders,
trauma.
drama.
To get rid of trauma, not to have more trauma.
Yay, trauma.
And go trauma.
Woohoo!
Okay, thanks everybody for joining us. We'll
Thank
catch you next
you.
week.